And now from the Institute of Politics at the University of Chicago and CNN Audio, The Axe Files, with your host, David Axelrod.
I sat down last week with Congressman Pete Aguilar of California, the chairman of the Democratic House Caucus, and as such, the highest-ranking Hispanic member of the U.S. House. We talked about his own story, which is quite a great American story, and about the gridlock that has enveloped Congress as crises mount over the budget, over the border, and over funding for Ukraine and Israel. We recorded this conversation in front of a live audience at the Cronkite School of Journalism and Mass Communications at Arizona State University.
Pete Aguilar, it's great to see you here at Arizona State. Here, not just for this conversation, but to see your beloved Dodgers. So welcome to spring training.
Absolutely, yes. I'll be at Camelback Ranch.
Tell me about baseball just for a second. This baseball was important to you when you were growing up.
Really important to me growing up. I've always been a Dodger fan, but I do have to admit that coming home from school, Catholic school as a kid, I would turn on the TV and everybody was a Braves fan or a Cubs fan too.
Yes,
those were on
that's
TV.
Good to hear.
Those were also on TV. But my parents were not into sports, but my brother and I were, and they didn't know what to do with us. And so they just kept putting us in sports, and we loved baseball. And so my brother and I played a lot of baseball growing up.
And I read somewhere you said your parents split up when you were in high school, and you said sports kind of got you through.
Yeah, I think that's really fair to say. My parents separated and then divorced when I was in high school. My brother played a huge role in my life. My parents were both, around, but it's a tough time in a household. And I played football and baseball, and the idea of going from school into sports, being able to kind of lose myself, in that for a few hours. Really meant a lot. And then I got cut from my high school baseball team. So then I learned how to play golf. So I still was out of the house.
I had as a guest in a podcast that went up today, actually, former Senator Bill Bradley, who who not only was a Rhodes Scholar at Princeton and a United States Senator, but also is in the Basketball Hall of Fame. And I asked him about where he learned his greatest leadership lessons, and he said the 10 years that he was playing in the NBA and the camaraderie with teammates and so on. Did you find that? Did you learn from your sport?
I am no Bill Bradley, not a Rhodes Scholar, not a Hall of Fame athlete, but the lessons that sports teaches you in general, teamwork, the importance of working together, especially, baseball and football, big team sports, that was incredibly helpful to me, but also just patience and poise, discipline, hard work, that you generally win the games before you even have them, based on your effort and your work and your preparation. All of those pieces were just so helpful to me, such important life lessons, and something that I take over to this job as well.
Well, let me talk to you about your family and your family history. Fourth generation Hispanic American. I read a touching story about your grandfather, who was a Korean War veteran, and lost his sight over time, and yet ran the cafeteria in one of the government buildings in San Bernardino County.
Yeah, it was really just such a formative. I mean, he was the person in my life. My parents were amazing, but I hung out with my grandparents a lot. The lessons that they taught us every weekend, large Latino family, we all lived in the same city. So we all, the only question every weekend was, whose house are we going to be at? Is it going to be my uncles, my aunts, my grandparents? Are we hosting? And my grandfather just taught us so many lessons about hard work. And I, as a kid, he was blind and he worked. And I didn't think anything of it. But the adversity that he had, Korean War, then he worked for the railroad, and then he lost his eyesight through a disease. And his life could have went in a number of directions. And my dad was a teenager at the time when my grandfather completely lost his sight. My grandmother and a friend of his turned him on to a small government program through the Department of Rehabilitation. that was, it's a small program called the Randolph Shepherd Act mm-hmm. that still exists to this day to give individuals, legally blind individuals, a preference to be owner operators. On the East Coast, this tends to be like rest stops and things. And on the West Coast, it has kind of tended to be, you know, military commissaries, courthouse cafeterias, which my grandfather ran. It was my first job as a kid, you know, 13 years old, 14 years old, working for him over the summers and the holidays, whenever we didn't have school, bussing tables. It was a single cash register. And people would come up to him and he would ask people two questions. What do you have and what are you giving me? And people say, Manuel, number one, enchiladas, beans and rice, and a Diet Coke, and a 10. And he would make change. And he knew his cash register. He knew his cafeteria. He also knew his yard. He mowed his lawn until he was, you know, in his 70s, you know, edging his lawn by hand, mowing his lawn. I mean, he just had such command of those two places, that he spent 99% of his time. And, but just, it just taught so much to me about community and family that he would put his faith in people, to tell them the truth and to give them. And some people didn't know, like, what do you mean? Can't you see? I have because some people didn't know that he was blind because he operated so efficiently. Well, of course I have a Diet Coke. You can't see that. But it was so formative, so helpful for me, but it was also that one government program changed the arc of my family's history. My grandfather got to go back to work. He got to help his family. He got to provide for his family, taught them life lessons, raised five amazing kids, my dad being one of them, blue-collar family. Nobody went to college right out of high school. My brother and I were the first to go to college in the family. But it just taught us so much about hard work and determination.
Yeah, and your note about the Randolph Shepherd Act, that was passed in the New Deal years. Yep. By Randolph Jennings from West Virginia was the sponsor of that legislation. And I think it's important to note because there is such jaundice about government today in many quarters. But your story is not, it's inspiring, but it's not unique. And you, in fact, you were educated with Pell Grants.
Yeah, I was a Pell Grant kid. A lot of people here on the ASU campus receive Pell Grants. That program, you know, helped me. But it is these things that you highlight, David, that these are real government programs. These are real things that help people succeed and help give people a hand up. And it's so important that we just don't lose sight of this kind of big G government when we talk about things, because there are so many impactful programs. But I'll tell you, my staff and my office probably know more about the Randolph Shepherd Act than a lot of members as a result of this. We take a lot of pride and ownership behind it. I want to see it succeed.
So let me talk to you about your folks. Your father worked for a utility company for, I think, 37 years. Or I read somewhere that you said that they did not want you to learn Spanish. Why was that?
Yeah, there was so much at the time my parents went to high school, there was, you know, so much discrimination. And if you spoke Spanish, you hung out over there. And so they raised us to be assimilated. They raised us that we were absolutely going to college. They didn't know where. They didn't really know what that meant, by the way, either. But that we were going to college, that we were going to do well, but they didn't want us held down by anything. And, you know, they would make a different decision now, probably.
And how are you raising your kid?
Well, my kids are in Spanish, but they're in high school. They're high school boys, David. So this is, you know.
So raising is an advised term.
It's a very loose term.
Yes.
But we're trying. We're trying. Mm-hmm. But for them, it was a difficult, you know, decision. But they would almost, you know, keep us away from Spanish in the house. They would speak Spanish to each other. My grandparents would speak Spanish to them, but they didn't want the grandkids to speak as much Spanish growing up.
Let me ask you a question, because we in the punditocracy, you know, we talk about the Hispanic vote as if it is a monolithic kind of vote and a monolithic community. that is really far from the reality. Talk a little bit about that.
It truly is, and we know this. We know this in data, but we just know this anecdotally, and Arizona teaches us a lot of these lessons too. You can't talk to the Latino community in Phoenix the same way that you talk to the Latino community in the Rio Grande Valley in South Texas, or in South Florida, or in Southern California even. They are just very different communities, but even then, the difference between first-generation Latinos versus third- and fourth-generation Latinos is very different as well. And so from the political punditocracy, side, it's just so different. And I agree. I mean, we're not a monolith, but it is almost, it's very regional. And I think people who make mistakes, including, at times, presidential campaigns, try to use one brush with the community when it has to be much more nuanced. It has to be much more specific, but it should still be aspirational. The Latino mm-hmm. dream is the American dream, better quality of life for our kids, better education, clean air, clean water, upward mobility. That's what we all care about. But there is some nuance that just sometimes is lost on people.
Well, you say mistakes are made by presidential candidates. One of them has been that immigration, that the entire, every Latino voter in the country has the same view on immigration and border issues and so on. I mean, we're learning that is certainly not the case. And my guess is that a fourth generation Hispanic American might have a different view than a new American.
I think that's right, but I see this too. There's 42 members of the Congressional Hispanic Caucus. Each of us has our own family story and history as well, and each of us approaches this issue differently. We all feel passionate about this, and there is some differing viewpoints at times, but our compassion and our humanity is really the kind of guiding point when it comes to our democratic values. We debate, we discuss, we disagree, but ultimately we want a system that works. And I think the frustration that people see today at the border, and we should acknowledge that it is a broken system, and it is in part broken because Congress for over 30 years has not done anything about it. We have not put a pathway to citizenship for Dreamers, which should be the easiest
issue you've been working on.
An issue that I feel passionate about and have been working on in a bipartisan way for years. But if we can't do that, which should be the simplest thing that probably 85% of the country agrees in, how can we be expected to do big things? And so it's a frustration point, but it's something that is, so important. And I fundamentally believe that, executive action is just not the solution on this. Congress needs to do the hard work and the big
things.
Well,
you raised this because in the last few weeks, President was a party to negotiations between Republicans and Democrats in the Senate, and an independent senator from the state of Arizona, and agreed to a very, very stringent border security bill to deal with the crisis at the border. And then Donald Trump got involved and didn't want Republicans agreeing to it because he said he wanted the issue would be a lifeline for Democrats and so on. And so Republicans backed up out of the bill. Now, as of today, as we sit here, there's a sense that, have you talked to the president about his plans? I mean, do you know what his plans are?
I haven't talked to the president.
But he said, apparently his plan is to, through executive action, to use a law that Trump used, that the courts threw out, to essentially deprive immigrants who come here illegally of the right to asylum. What is your feeling about it?
Well, I don't want to get ahead of, and I don't know what is final from a proposal perspective, and you know this from your prior job. There's always
trial balloons.
There's always trial balloons and things that are floated, and so I want to deal with fact, and the fact is Congress has walked away from our ability to do something big. The Senate had a bipartisan solution. It was not perfect. I had concerns about aspects of the proposal. I'm happy to go chapter and verse with you on, but it was a bipartisan solution that had 60 votes in the Senate, and that is how we pass laws. And so, but Speaker Johnson said, pretty early on that he did not want to give any oxygen, you know, to this. He did not want this to succeed. And then President Trump weighed in, and that's it. Donald Trump's grip on the Republican Party is so strong, it will prevent anything positive from
Would you have voted for that bill?
I think Democratic leadership would have needed to have a lot of discussions about this. Look, as chair of the Democratic caucus, my job is also to convene everybody and to make sure that everybody is heard, make sure we all have the same information and we're operating on the same wavelength. And I would have wanted to do that with this proposal if it came from the Senate as is. I would want to make sure everybody had the right information. Ultimately, on balance, I think that it would have been something that I would have voted for, and I think that it would have had overwhelming support within the House of Representatives.
I got to applaud you because you actually answered my question at the end there. I thought you, as you were going through the windup to it, speaking of baseball, I thought, I guess this is how you get to be the head of the Democratic caucus. But
my default is to just tell the truth, and maybe
that's good. I think that's good. Just one last question on this. Why do you think President Biden won 65% of the Hispanic vote, just to violate the same precept that I laid down before, but in 2020, he is running about even now. Why is that?
You know, I think, and again, I think we have to really break into the numbers and talk about subregions.
Right.
The South Florida community is very, very different than the South Arizona community.
Yes.
So understanding, you know, all of that. But I do think that there is such an important story to tell on behalf of the president here. Creation of 14 million jobs, the investment here in Arizona from the Chips and Science Act alone, $2 billion coming to onshore jobs that for 30 years have been leaving the country. The record number of opportunities for job creation is so real, and the president has to take credit for that. And within the Latino community, this is a lot of workforce jobs. These are jobs that, that our kids...
He has been trying to take credit for it, but people aren't feeling it.
Yeah.
I mean, and what they feel is their reality.
Yeah, no, and absolutely. And Democrats and the president need to, you know, as well, you know, talk about where people feel in their own lives and acknowledge that there are rising costs that people feel. And at times it feels like that opportunity is slipping away. Most specifically, I think for Arizonans and for Southern Californians, the common denominator for a lot of us is on housing. And affordable housing, and people feeling that their kids aren't going to have an opportunity to live in the communities in which they were raised. And that has to be something that we talk about from a policy perspective. We've had legislative solutions within Build Back Better that didn't go anywhere. And I'll give credit to Maxine Waters and a lot of House Democrats who worked on these things. But people need to feel more comfortable in their lives before they acknowledge that an elected official, the president, any politician is helping create X amount of jobs. And we need to connect those dots for people. But I just don't know if that's possible without addressing really core issues that people face. Rising healthcare costs. You know, we were able to lower the insulin costs for seniors, but only for seniors. There's more work to be done there. But housing specifically is something that we need to focus on and work on.
I don't want to lose the thread of your story because I read that you became interested in politics, at least notionally, or was exposed to it as a 9-year-old when you embarked on a petition campaign aimed at the Exxon Mobil company. So first of all, what kind of 9-year-old were you?
You know, it's a question my mom asks a lot. But this is the story she tells of like when she knew I was a little different. in her words. But it was 9 years old, and you know, there was only, you know, 8 or 9 channels on TV, right? And the Exxon Valdez happens. 11 million gallons of crude oil, you know, spill into the Alaska waters. And I was just so kind of taken with the images of the wildlife, and then the stories of this, you know, captain, and just the raw negligence of this company. And but I didn't know what to do about it. And
as so, 9 year olds wouldn't.
Yeah. Well, I wrote a letter. So I wrote a letter to the CEO of Exxon, and then I went to, I told you, full circle, right? My family meets every weekend, generally, or they did as a kid. And my Uncle John tells me on that weekend, he says, well, you know what you should do? You should do a petition. If you really want people to know what you're doing, you should do a petition. I said, well, I don't know what a petition is. He said, well, you wrote a letter. Now get people to sign on that they agree with your letter, that something needs to be done and they need to be held accountable. And so I think I rewrote my letter even. And then I had my relatives all sign it. I didn't let any kids sign
it. Sounds like you had a big family. That's probably a hunk of signatures right there.
Yeah. That's enough to get you on the ballot in some jurisdictions. And so none of the kids signed it, only aunts, uncles. And then I took it to school and I had teachers sign it. And then I went door to door in my neighborhood, and these neighbors had no idea what to do with me. Right. But they knew me. I was playing baseball and riding my bike in the street. And they're like, look, you want me to sign something and not buy anything? Like, I'm in. Like, if you're not selling me any cookies or candy for Little League, then I'm in. So I ended up then my uncle said one last thing. He said, send it registered mail, so you know that they received it, right? And so it had the little postcard on it that they received it. Somebody signed for it at some point in a to be put in the P.O. box or something. I never got a response.
Sounds like your uncle could have been a pretty fair organizer.
He you know, he was, and he's a great human being. But that was it was. Important, informative for me, because, you know, I wanted to take action. I wanted to make the world a better place. I saw something that I didn't like. I didn't know what to do, but I didn't want to ignore it.
We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back with more of the Axe Files.
This podcast is supported by Sleep Number. Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores? Sleep Number does that. Only Sleep Number Smart Beds let you each choose your ideal comfort and support, your Sleep Number setting. Sleep Number Smart Beds learn how you sleep and provide personalized insights to help you sleep better. All Sleep Number smart beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. Temperature-balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
And now, back to the show.
So you went to Redlands, the University of Redlands, which is in your area, and I looked up the website of the University of Redlands, and the first thing it said was, become a champion of social action, make a difference in your career and community. You did that when you got there.
Yeah, I was really just drawn to that mission and that focus, and the university is one of the few places. They also required you to have a community service a component to graduate, and I was just kind of drawn to that and taken
you,
by that.
You started a Habitat for Humanity program.
I did. My first job was I was a Head Start teacher's aide for my first year, only because, well, I had a big family, I liked kids, but I had a vehicle, and a lot of kids at school don't have vehicles, so I had a vehicle, and I got to drive to Head Start, and I was Mr. Pete. And that is still a nickname that some people who went to college with me still call me Mr. Pete. And then my sophomore year, I worked at Habitat for Humanity. There was a campus chapter that existed. We kind of brought it back to life. We had faculty builds, we had student builds, and so organizing, students and faculty and friends, on Saturday mornings to help. And I was handy. My uncle was, worked a lot, roofers and landscapers, and come from a family that does a lot of work. And so I enjoyed it, and ended up serving on Habitat's board locally, and enjoyed my time there.
So you graduated, and you, I guess, pretty quickly got appointed deputy director of the Inland Empire Regional Office for the governor of California. How'd you get that gig?
I interned. The second time I got in an airplane was to intern in Washington, D.C., is a summer program through the University of Redlands. And then I came back and I was just kind of bit by the political bug between interning. And this was another big piece of my life at this point was West Wing. The show West Wing.
Yes.
And
you had West Wing parties at your house.
We had West Wing parties. People weren't allowed to talk. There was no DVR. We were very, very mean. couldn't talk. You had to leave if you wanted to talk about something. Bradley Whitford, I have shared with him that this is so important.
The star of the show.
The star of the show was a great guy. And this was just a moment in a time that I just enjoyed, and I got back to Southern California and I wanted to do politics. I didn't know what that meant. My parents voted every election, but they didn't know what professions were associated with it. And so I worked through a friend, Roger Salazar, who's in Sacramento, was a University of Redlands alum and Clinton Gore guy, and worked on a bunch of races. He got me hooked up with Governor Gray Davis, and so I interned for Governor Davis my senior year in high school, and then they offered me a gig. So right after, I think I graduated on Saturday, and I think I started work on maybe Wednesday, and worked in the governor's regional office representing the area I now serve in, the kind of broader two-county Inland Empire area. The area that I was raised in, we're 65 miles from downtown L.A., often in the shadows of LA, and working class communities. And I loved it. I loved representing the governor in that area. I knew it well. But in this role, I had to work with elected Republicans and chambers of commerce and business people. And I think it just taught me so much about the kind of broader layers of the community, the grassroots organizers, the community leaders, the faith leaders. And so then that just, added to, all of everything that I had done, and just gave me an ability to kind of speak to folks.
Well, you must have impressed somebody, because when you were 26, the city council had a vacancy in Redlands and appointed you to the city council. And then a few years later, they appointed you mayor of Redlands, California.
Yeah, keeping in mind that each of those, to get on the city council, I only needed to count to 3 votes at the time. There was a vacancy. So I do much better at counting votes when it's in smaller numbers, David. So filled a vacancy at the time, 4 members of the city council. I think it was 14 of us who applied. I was by far the youngest and applying, former city commissioners and things, applied. And I just kind of shared my story, and all of the members of the council knew me. And I was very mindful that I didn't have to be everybody's first choice, but if I was everybody's second choice, that might also work. And so the importance of counting votes.
Yeah, man. That's pretty sophisticated for a young guy.
It was a decent operation we ran.
I thought maybe they had seen your Exxon Valdez letter. And
yeah. I don't know if that would have played well in Redlands, to be honest with you.
That's true. That's true. And tell just one question about just being mayor of a city. That experience, I'm a big fan of, I used to do mayoral races all over the country, and I covered City Hall in Chicago, and I always felt that local government was actually the most vibrant level of government, because you live with people and you're living their problems and you see what you can do. And you do it. Tell me about what you learned from being mayor that was useful later.
I love that job. I mean, and I have just such respect for all of our local officials at every level. I mean, you have to navigate these issues in a nonpartisan way. And what you have to do is you just have to focus on what's the solution. Like, how do we solve these issues? And that's what I loved about it, is being part of a group of five individuals who genuinely were focused on it. We knew generally how we were voting for president, you know, between the five of us. And that's fine. We set that aside. And it was like, how do we reinvest in infrastructure? You know, how do we create a better park system? You know, how do we plan for the future? We were one of the first cities to have a climate action plan just because it was the right thing to do. I mean, just those, you know, little things that are so impactful. But you also have to know, as mayor, you have to know everything that is going on within the four walls of that city, because people are holding you accountable for it. And, you know, they're holding you accountable on a daily basis. If you're going to shopping, you're going to the supermarket, you're walking around town, you know, people know you, and they expect answers. And I've tried to carry that over too. And I tell our team and my staff, like, when people come to us with an issue, it's not our responsibility to say, oh, well, that's a state issue, or you should really talk to your local city council member. Like, no, they expect us to try to help them and to navigate the system and to provide resolution no matter what the issue is. We're capital G government to a lot of people, and we have to act. We have to help.
You ran for Congress in 2012. The district had been changed after reapportionment. It was thought to be a Democratic-leaning district, but you have this jungle primary in California where the first two candidates win, whether they're Republicans or Democrats. Everybody runs together. I guess this is an opportune time to ask you about how you feel about that system, but we'll talk about that in a second, but you lost. So here you were, you had this meteoric political rise, and I think there was an expectation that you would be, that you would win or at least be competitive in that race. You didn't make the cut.
Yeah.
How did you process that? Was it devastating?
It was hard. Look, I mean, we've talked about sports being formative. I don't like losing at anything. I don't like losing playing pickleball. I don't like losing playing board games with the kids. I don't like losing at all. And to lose at this level, and what was seen is in such a public way, really, you know, did stick with me, and it hurt. But the opportunity to serve, the opportunity to do well by my community, I still knew fundamentally that, you know, we needed a Democratic voice at the table representing this region, that this was a Democratic seat and or should be, and that there were things that needed to be done. And so I didn't just jump in right away. I took some time to reflect, to talk to the family. I'm not sure if Alicia's secret ballot, you know, still holds.
Your wife,
on what my wife wanted. But, you know, We're committed. We're committed as a family to help make the region and the country a better place. And it's something we feel passionate about and we talk to our kids about. So it was a very public way to fail, but it taught me a lot. But from a raw political perspective that you can appreciate, I mean, after the maps were redrawn, we weren't given a ton of time. I ran a 19-week campaign, and you just can't do that. And so having an opportunity to run a 19-month campaign, you know, after that, was much easier, and something that we were able to do. The same result almost happened again, actually, but it's just a raw math issue when it comes to this jungle primary. If you are in a low turnout district, and four Democrats are splitting the vote and two Republicans are there, like, this is just math. It is not politics. It is not fancy. It is just math. And making sure that doesn't happen in some of these districts is something that I take personal.
Yeah. It's math, but it's better be on the side of addition than subtraction, I think.
Yeah, you always want to build coalitions. Yeah. And
So you went to Congress, but you made a quick ascent there as well. In the last Congress. You also served on the January 6th committee. Tell me about that experience, and tell me about what you anticipated and what you learned.
Oh man, how much time do we have? It was such an important experience, and I think the best way to summarize it was just the volume of work that we had to accomplish. And I'll tell a story about getting on the committee too here in a minute. But, you know, my wife had told me, you know, this could be the most important thing that you ever do. And so just make sure that you do it right.
I'm sure your kids felt good about that.
Yeah. I mean, you know, when I'm on family vacations locked away in depositions, you know, on Zoom, participating in depositions.
They said, hey, we were the most important things.
Yeah. This, you know, in public life, this could be, you know, something that is the most important. And so I just wanted to do it right. I just wanted, and just that this drive to just make sure. And one thing that I tried to do, I know you had Stephanie Murphy, my former colleague.
Yes, who was on that committee.
On the committee, you know, and I remember I remember the call Nancy Pelosi gave me, and this was something that, and Stephanie wanted to be on the committee. She wanted to be on the January 6th.
Stephanie, we should point out, for those who didn't hear the podcast, was a Vietnamese refugee. Who ultimately was elected to Congress, extraordinarily bright, but very passionate about democracy for reasons that you can understand.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so, but I was vice chair of the Democratic Caucus. I was helping out. I was new to this leadership role, and that was taking a lot of time. And Speaker Pelosi called and said, you know, we created this commission. And by the way, stepping back, Stephanie wanted, I wanted, all of us, we wanted a bipartisan 9/11 style commission, right? And Mitch McConnell walked into the Senate and said, you know, do me a favor and vote against this bipartisan plan to investigate January 6th. And so at that point, Speaker Pelosi felt, we can't ignore this. We have to do something, even if it's just us. And that's the point at which people started advocating and raising their hands and saying that they would want to serve. I did not do that. And so Speaker Pelosi called me and said, we created this committee. I've heard from a lot of your colleagues who want to serve. I said, that's great. Democratic Caucus is full of amazing people, and we will find great folks to serve on this committee. And she says, why haven't I heard from you? And I said, well, Speaker.
She has the gift of directness, doesn't she?
I think you know that as well.
Yes, yes.
And I said, well, I don't know. I just, due to this leadership role, I don't know if I want that. And I don't know if I want to deal with the death threats. And, you know, with the young family.
Yeah.
And
which is a sad commentary.
It is. And so she paused and she said, okay, but you'll do it, right? And I said, yeah, yes, Madam Speaker, I'll do it. And she said, this was at 10:30 at night. And she said, okay, be in my office at 9 o'clock tomorrow. We have a 10 a.m. Press conference where I'm announcing that you're on the committee. And she said, and you can't tell anyone. I said, can I tell my wife? Can I tell Alicia? And she paused and she says, yeah, you can tell Alicia. So I feel this kind of impacts her.
You know, Steve Israel, who served in Congress for 16 years, said of Pelosi, when you go to Nancy's office, there are two things you notice. There's always chocolates on the table and a baseball bat in the corner. And she's perfectly willing to use either.
It's true. She will use whatever she needs to. The importance of the committee, though, in investigating and finding out what happened on January 6th, not just to protect democracy, but to tell the full and complete story. And I thought that Chairman Benny Thompson and Vice Chair Liz Cheney, we spent so much time together. But as we told that story, one of the things I suggested at the beginning was 30% of the country is going to love what we do, no matter what it comes out as. And 30% of the country isn't going to believe it. And it's how we speak to that 40% during these hearings that is going to matter, because some people are only going to watch 5 minutes, and some people are going to watch one hearing, but they're not going to watch any others. And so, you know, I thought that the committee just did such a good job in conveying the information that we received from the depositions in such a digestible way, that it was a tribute to the professionalism of the committee staff.
Could you have done it if it was a bipartisan? Obviously you had two Republicans on there, but they were Republicans who were willing to do it because they shared your view of fact finding here. But if it had been a bipartisan committee, would it have been as effective?
If it would have been a bipartisan
committee, yeah.
Yeah, no, I think the bipartisan side of it gave us.
I understand, but I'm saying, had McCarthy named members to the committee, because wouldn't their role have been to contest?
It would have taken on a different feel. And
so it was kind
of
a unique thing.
It was unique. It was there aren't, and you've been around these congressional hearings, David. Usually, right, every member gets 5 minutes to ask their questions, right? And some people make it, newsworthy, and you know, whether that's, you know, with whiteboards or with speeches, right? They find a way to communicate in a crisp and effective way in 5 minutes, and that is a skill. But what we stepped back and said is, a committee, what's most effective? Is that structure work? And do we have to do that structure? And what we decided was, look, we can do it any way we want. And so, you know, Benny Thompson basically assigned each member a hearing. And that was your hearing. You were responsible for the content of that hearing, the flow of that hearing, the questions of that hearing, and the witnesses. And so we had these themes, and my hearing was...
Fake elector.
The fake electors was one of the themes that was so impactful. The Georgia pressure campaigns, all of these pieces.
I thought that was yours. What was yours?
Mine was Pence.
Pence, yes.
Mine was Mike Pence. And that's when we ran the footage, and a staffer on the committee who works for me now, you know, found out the mob was 40 feet from Mike Pence. And, you know, we didn't, to that time, at that time, we didn't know that until we looked at the video, until we talked to them and the testimony and Mike Pence's team, just how clearly and crisply we talked about that, and we put that in terms that people could understand, and how Mike Pence started his day, you know, leading a prayer circle with his senior staff, and he ended his day getting, you know, the Bible verse, you know, from his team that, you know, you run the race and you served, and just everything that in between that was his day of pressure, and that the former president put on him to shame him, to try to violate the Constitution, was just so striking.
We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back with more of the Axe Files.
The Assignment with me, Audie Cornish. There's been a ton of writing about the album Cowboy Carter since it dropped this spring. But what grabbed my attention is a new documentary on CNN called Call Me Country, Beyoncé and Nashville's Renaissance. Lots of artists have tried to boot scoot their way onto country music charts. Why did this album cause such a stir? And what about both this pop star and this political moment has caused all this conversation? Listen to The Assignment with me, Audie Cornish, on your favorite podcast app.
And now, back to the show.
So do you think that there would have been indictments if you hadn't laid out the investigation the way you did?
I wish the indictments would have come sooner, you know, either way. I think the Department of Justice would even agree that they have looked at our depositions. They read the material that we made public, that was something that was helpful for them.
The case they laid out is very much along the tracks of what you guys did. But you say you wish they had done it sooner. Do you think that this case will the January 6th case that sits in Washington right now will actually be tried before the election?
You know, that's a question.
How important is it is another question.
It's important. The focus of the January 6th committee was that we get to the truth and that people are held accountable. And at every level, we wanted accountability. And through our work, we found that the president was ultimately, you know, responsible and a key player in this pressure campaign, and deserves a measure of accountability. That's what I'm focused on. That's what I want. The Justice Department, the justice system will work if he is held accountable. Timelines and
does it trouble you that he has gotten politically stronger as these indictments have come down?
It does. It troubles me as an American, not just as a Democrat. I mean, as a politician. I mean, this troubles me as an American that he can say something, whether that's level a threat to somebody or tell people to take a different position, i.e. immigration that we talked about, and that people will follow him and people will do what he says. But that is also the story of January 6th. He told people, come to Washington, and we will fix this. That is what he, and we interviewed and deposed, you know, dozens and dozens of people who were just kind of caught up in it, but they firmly believed that they were doing what the president.
Well, if you believe that the election was stolen, then you can see how you would believe that it was your patriotic duty to try and stop that election from being certified. So the original lie about the election was really the thing upon which everything else followed.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and it came down to the big lie, and what we proved time and time again is, you know, the president even knew that he had not won the election. He had told people that, but it was this act that he was portraying and going out in public and whipping up the crowd and telling people to come on January 6th, it'll be wild. Mm-hmm. You know, all of those things just kind of fed into it. And then it shouldn't be lost on any of us. The Republican Party made hundreds of millions of dollars after the election in November and December under the auspices of recounts and, mm-hmm. and helping us prove that we won. They raised, you know, $200 million, you know, in a short period of time, and, you know, all because it whipped up their crowd. And yeah. And those folks are still active, they're still engaged, and it's a problem.
You know, I wept when I saw the scenes at the Capitol, because it was such a defiling of everything that makes us strong, including the rule of law. And it was heartbreaking to me. Yeah, I was worried about my friends in Congress, but I was even more worried about this democracy of ours, which we treat as a gift, but really as a project, and requires us each generation to renew our commitment to it. So I never thought I'd see a moment like that. And I'm sure you never thought you'd see a moment like that.
I didn't. And my experience, I was on the House chamber. It was because of COVID rules, it was a limited number. We were not supposed to have more than, I think, 40, 60 people, you know, on the House floor. Republicans didn't observe that, by the way. And so they had more people on the floor than we did. We were spaced out, and Colin Allred was near me, and Sean Patrick Maloney was behind him. I was behind Jamie Raskin, right on the aisle, like when they introduced the president for the State of the Union, like that aisle, I was like right there, third row. And, you know, the interesting thing in the lead up to this, Zoe Lofgren had asked the question in her role as House Administration that oversees the Capitol Police. And I remember specifically being on a conference call where she had asked the police chief, you know, we've heard these things, what do you say? And their comment was, every eventuality had been thought through. And it made me feel comfortable, because I believe law enforcement, if they tell you that you're going to be safe and that things have been thought through, then I default to that. And so we get there.
you should have gone to law school because
then you question everything.
Every eventuality has been gone through. They didn't say every eventuality has been gone through and we're prepared for it.
Yeah. And so I'm on the House floor, and all we have really is Twitter. But even not every member is kind of scrolling through this. We didn't know, to be honest with you, 80%, a large percentage of people on the House floor had no idea what was going on outside, because we got to work early. We showed up. It's this exercise. We knew there were going to be some challenges. We knew Republicans were going to challenge the count. We're prepared. We're figuring out who's going to speak and all of those pieces. But we got there at, 11 o'clock on the House floor. And this is hours later that the mob had come. And I remember, kind of texting friends and people texting, are you okay? And I said, oh, this is the, and I thought everything's fine. And then it was, I remember showing Colin Allred the tweet that said, protesters are in the building. And I in my mind, I felt that this was like someone running onto a baseball field. Someone's going to break in, they're going to get tackled by 12 people, and then it's over. And we just didn't know until we started hearing sounds in the hallway, and until the sergeant at arms came over and said, we're suspending these operations. Then the chaplain came and did a prayer, and I'm like, where am I at? And what is going on here? And then I keep a little red book with me at times and scribble some notes, and I didn't write much. I wish I wrote more that day, but it, at the time I wrote, at 2:37 p.m., I wrote, I'm a little scared. And, to me, that was just like, I didn't know what was going to happen. And then you hear banging on the door. And then at that point, we were escorted out. And I didn't have the toughest day. The people who had the toughest time, aside from our brave law enforcement officials, were the members in the gallery. So that gallery group, because of COVID restrictions, as I told you, members were told, if you want to watch and you're not invited to be on the floor, go to the gallery. And at one point, Mitt Romney was up in the gallery and, the joint proceeding. But the members, it was all Democratic members who stuck in there, and they got trapped, basically. They spent 8 minutes, they got evacuated 8 minutes later than we did. It was a long 8 minutes. That's when Ashley Babbitt was shot. That's when, protesters were running around. I mean, it was real. And a lot of those members have talked about that experience and sought help. And they are brave for making that piece public. But it was a tough.
Did you hear from your wife during this period?
I did. And she tried not to. She was watching it on TV and she was trying not to alarm me. East Coast, West Coast. So it was still a little earlier. But she woke up the kids and the teenage boys again. I'm sorry. They're sleeping in at 10 a.m. And she woke them up and said, something's happening at the Capitol. You need to know about this. I'm texting your dad. We're okay. And then it was later in the afternoon. Another member had said, I don't know if we're all safe. And members with good relationships back home with their law enforcement texted my police chief and said, can you give me a little bit of help? And so they put a cop car at my door, in my home, just to make sure, because we didn't know what was happening. We didn't know, is this a coordinated attempt, is this not? And at that point the leadership had been whisked away. And basically our conference and caucus was being led. We were in one big room in the Longworth building, and it was Hakeem Jeffries and Liz Cheney, who were the chairs of their conferences. The highest ranking members, this is a distinction Hakeem talks about. He was the highest ranking member without a detail, because once you have the detail, they take you to safety. They have to. That was our experience and story.
You have that job now.
I have that job now.
Yeah. Yeah, you talk about the Trump's sort of ability to brand and sell his story He's now very much in control of events in Washington. Over the past few weeks, not only has the immigration bill been stalled, but you have not been able to pass aid for Ukraine. Ukraine just had to retreat for lack of ammunition. The aid to Israel has been stalled as well. When you get back on Monday, or I guess Monday?
Wednesday.
Yeah. It's not like there's anything urgent. When you get back there, do you expect that there will be action on these fronts?
The American people deserve us to take action.
Right. That's a different question.
It's a different question. But it's important to note the House of Representatives functions in a majority-run institution. If the speaker does not want something to happen, if a majority of members do not want an outcome, they can generally stop it from happening. Now, what we need, government funding is another big issue coming forward. But this national security supplemental, Ukraine aid, Israel aid, humanitarian assistance to Gaza, Indo-Pacific priorities, these are the national security imperatives are so important and so impactful. What we need are our reasonable colleagues to step up and either push the speaker to put this on the floor for an up or down vote, or join with us to try to figure out.
There are procedural things you could do to force it out.
Procedural and mechanisms in which we can force a vote. Either way, back to my original point, the American people deserve us to vote on this up or down. And I'm confident that there are 300 votes in the House of Representatives to pass this national security aid package.
The Ukrainian people have a stake in this as well.
Absolutely. And, what sometimes isn't connected to why the Republican Party, why House Republicans and Donald Trump are so soft on Putin, I just don't understand. But it is true. And where this is impactful and meaningful for us here back home is, if Putin's march continues and we are dragged into this in Poland through NATO, it's going to be Americans who are boots on the ground and serving. And that is one thing that every policymaker at every level, it is the most difficult decision to ever make, and we want to prevent that from happening. And supporting Ukraine in their fight for democracy here helps ensure that that doesn't happen.
So we talked about Pelosi earlier. She was at the peak of her power, and she left the leadership. And she persuaded Steny Hoyer and Jim Clyburn, the number two and number three members of the House, to go with her, all of them in their 80s, because she felt that there should be a torch passing, a generational change. And you are all younger. You're 44 years old, I think. Hakeem Jeffrey, barely 50. Yeah. How old is Catherine Clark? I mean, she's in the... So you got the generational change. Has that been invigorating, do you think, for the caucus?
All I can tell you is the Democratic caucus has just been so amazing throughout all of this. But to learn from Hakeem Jeffries and Catherine Clark, and I all learned from Nancy Pelosi and Steny Hoyer. We sat at the leadership table, the broader leadership table with that group. We learned from them. We hold them up. They are the Mount Rushmore of Democratic politicians to come out of the House.
So
the Democratic caucus has just treated us so well and been so open to that, and all guided by the focus too. And I think to a person, the Democratic caucus will tell you our mission, our job, our focus is to make sure a Democrat holds the White House, but to also make sure that Hakeem Jeffries becomes Speaker of the House next year.
I presume it is. The social media model is predicated on playing to our sense of grievance, of difference, of anger, of outrage, and drives us into silos in which the information we get is often filtered information that affirms our point of view, and everybody outside the silo is treated as an enemy. And that has seized our politics in a way that I think is really unhealthy, and it's something that we have to defeat. Is the House of Representatives governable right now? And how much has this kind of social media ethos of, you know, you're on the blue team, the red team, so on, seized control to make cooperation much more difficult?
Well, I think it's a great question, and you know, I don't know if I can answer this with that like Walter Cronkite, you know, 82 font, you know, right above me, without also mentioning that there aren't people like Mr. Cronkite. There aren't folks outside of course David Axelrod on CNN.
Thank you.
Who are those individuals who are looked at and revered and respected on both sides of the aisle, where the American public says, I believe that person. And so that's why I would tell you the work that you're doing here, the work the journalism school is doing here to kind of give you that grounding and focus to be truth tellers and to do it in a fair and honest way is so important and so impactful. We need those people in order for our system to work. We have to have those storytellers and truth tellers, you know, on TV. But to David's question, it is hard. It is hard in the social media world. It is hard when there are some people in politics who would rather be Twitter famous than to pass laws and actually help people. And I don't know how you fix that. And so I think my focus has been not on fixing that necessarily. I don't know if there's a fix for that, but we can marginalize that behavior by passing laws and by working in a collaborative way. And so that's why I have tried to be the person who Republicans feel comfortable reaching out to. And I think I've got a track record to prove that, where we can work on things, where we can disagree on topics A, B, and C. But you know what? On D and E, you know, I'm working with you and we're in this together, and I trust you, and you'll be honest with me and I'll be honest with you, and we can try to find a solution. That doesn't mean that we're going to agree on all that other stuff, but it means that we can at least be collegial and we can work on what's in front of us. And the Congress of the United States needs to do more of that. And there are serious legislators on the other side who do want to do that. But I will tell you, the number is diminishing.
Yeah. Well, you see a whole bunch of them leaving Congress.
Yeah.
Some of your most productive. And
because Congress is a place where you want to do big things, whether you're red team or blue team, you want to help, you want to do things. And oftentimes one of my critiques of Republicans is they are not trying to find a way to get to yes. They're just trying to find a way to mess things up, to slow things down without actually saying no.
I want to thank you, Pete Aguilar, not just for being here, but for your service and for your inspiration. Thank you.
Thank you, David. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Axe Files, brought to you by the Institute of Politics at the University of Chicago and CNN Audio. The executive producer of the show is Miriam Fender Annenberg. The show is also produced by Saralina Berry, Jeff Fox, and Hannah Grace McDonald. And special thanks to our partners at CNN, including Steve Lichtai and Haley Thomas. For more programming from the IOP, visit politics.uchicago.edu.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.